11 will illustrate Stoicism calls for involvement in public life, not retreat from it. But in all circumstances, one can draw lines between the decisions that are up to us and the ones that aren't. Epictetus Discourses 2:5-1-7. Material things are indifferent. How we use them is not. How then may a man maintain not only steadiness and calm, but also the state of mind that is careful and neither reckless nor negligent? He can act like people playing a board game. The game pieces are neither good nor bad, nor are the dice. How can I know what the next throw of the dice will be? But to use the throw carefully and skillfully, this belongs to me. In life, too, then, the principal task is this, to distinguish and separate things and say, externals are outside my power. My choices are within my power. Where shall I seek the good and the bad? Within, in the things that are my own. But in what depends on others, call nothing either good or bad, benefit or harm, or anything else of the kind. What then? Does this mean we shouldn't care how we use them? By no means. That would be a wrongful use of our faculty of choice, and so contrary to nature. External things should be used with care, because their use can be good or bad. But at the same time, you should keep your composure and your calm, because the things themselves are neither good nor bad. The comparison to dice is anticipated in Book 10 of Plato's Republic, 604c. Adam Smith elaborated on the Stoic comparison to the play of a game, and his account provides a good note on which to conclude this discussion. Smith, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, 1759. Human life, the Stoics appear to have considered as a game of great skill, in which, however, there was a mixture of chance, or of what is vulgarly understood to be chance. If we placed our happiness in winning the stake, we placed it in what depended upon causes beyond our power and out of our direction. We necessarily exposed ourselves to perpetual fear and uneasiness, and frequently to grievous and mortifying disappointments. If we placed it in playing well, in playing fairly, in playing wisely and skillfully, in the propriety of our own conduct, in short, we placed it in what, by proper discipline, education, and attention, might be altogether in our own power and under our own direction. Our happiness was perfectly secure and beyond the reach of fortune. Chapter 3. Perspective. Marcus Aurelius thought two principles of Stoicism especially important. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 4:3-4. These are the two ideas you should keep at the very front of your mind and think about. One is that things in the world do not touch your spirit, but stand quietly external to it. That which disturbs us comes only from the opinions within us. Second, everything you see changes in a moment and will soon be gone. Keep in mind always how many of these changes you have already seen. The world is constant change. Your life lies in your opinion. One of these points, that our experience of the world depends on our judgments or opinions about it, rather than on externals themselves, was the subject of the first two chapters. His other principle is the subject of this one. The principle might be stated as mortality or perishability, but for our purposes, it will be better to speak of those as parts of a larger topic, perspective. The Stoics may be said in general to use two strategies to dissolve an illusion. One is analytical, using reason to take apart an external and show its true nature. The other is intuitive, looking at the world from a point of view that can produce an automatic change in how we see it. Viewing a problem, an adversary, or oneself from a certain perspective, seeing it from far away, or as part of a bigger picture, can sometimes detach us from an appetite or fear without need for analysis. The Stoics use both methods throughout this book. Most of the chapters to come use analysis as the primary instrument of correction. Externals are taken up and scrutinized one by one. Time and space can be treated this way, for example, and receive some Stoic dissection in this chapter. To ourselves, we seem exceedingly important. and the time and place where we live feels significant. The Stoic regards those impressions as mistakes. They arise because our ordinary perspective on the world, the one we use by default, is misleading. We look out from inside and see things in terms of ourselves. We are forgetful or unconscious of how puny and brief our allotments are. The Stoics rectify this by pointing out the facts about the scale of our existence and our mortality. But the ideas in this chapter are also, and especially, meant to advance the intuitive side of Stoicism. By seeing how small our affairs look in the larger scheme of things, the Stoic means to induce a felt sense of humility and attraction to virtue. The method can be called intuitive because it isn't a matter of argument. It's more a question of showing and pointing and expecting perceptions and adjustments to follow directly from a new point of view. Granted, by not using arguments, the Stoics sometimes open themselves to analytical criticism. The choice to look at a problem from one point of view rather than another can seem arbitrary. But in this respect, as in many others, the late Stoics may be classified as pragmatists. If a perspective has the consequence of freeing us from a bad psychological habit, they do not hesitate to recommend it. A change in perspective can sometimes lead a viewer to more than one conclusion. The Stoics have specific ideas about which lessons are the right ones to draw. Staring at the small scale of our lives and concerns, for example, could seem nihilistic and dreary. But the Stoic has an opposite reaction. The long view is good for morale. If it is an affront to the ego, it is also an antidote to vanity, ambition, and greed. Our ultimate insignificance makes the case for living well in the present, for no other purpose survives. It also suggests the value of viewing oneself as part of a whole. If you wanted to convince ants to work together, rather than obsess about individual glory, you might start by showing them how they look to us. Nor should the long view lead to passivity. We have remarked already that two of our Stoic instructors were among the most significant statesmen of Rome. But the example of Marcus Aurelius is worth a moment of particular reflection. He was, as this chapter will show, the most persistent Stoic student of perspectives that make our affairs seem tiny. So far as our histories tell, though, none of this made him any less active or compassionate. Quite the contrary. De Quincey, The Caesars, 1851. It must be remembered that Marcus Aurelius was by profession a Stoic, and that generally, as a theoretical philosopher, but still more as a Stoic philosopher, he might be supposed incapable of descending from these airy altitudes of speculation to the true needs, infirmities, and capacities of human nature. Yet strange it is that he, of all the good emperors, was the most thoroughly human and practical. Someone who rightly understands Stoicism shouldn't find that observation strange at all. 1. Time. We measure time by how much of it we have. A normal lifespan seems a long increment because it is the most that anyone knows of firsthand. The Stoic seeks to view time from the outside in, a point of view that creates a different sense of scale. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 9:32. You can get rid of a great number of your annoyances because they lie entirely in your own head. You will clear ample space for yourself by comprehending the scale of the universe in your mind, by observing the infinity of time, and by studying carefully the rapid change of each part of each thing, how short the time is from birth to dissolution, the time before it, an abyss, the time afterwards, also endless. Seneca, Epistles, 99:10. Imagine the vast abyss of time, and think of the entire universe. Then compare what we call a human lifetime to that immensity. You will see how tiny a thing it is that we wish for and seek to prolong. Seneca, Epistles, 49:3. We live for an instant, even less than an instant. But nature adds mockery to even this trivial span by giving it an appearance of longer extent, making one part infancy, another childhood, another youth, another the gradual slope, so to speak, from youth to old age, another old age itself. How many steps for so short a climb? Seneca, Consolation to Marcia, 21:3. You might name long-lived men, men of legendary old age. You might count up 110 years for each. But when you turn your mind toward the whole of time, the difference between the shortest and the longest life will be nothing, if, having examined the intervals, you compare the time each has lived with the time he has not lived. 2. Space. The importance of our place is likewise determined for us by the scale we experience as we move through it, what we can see, where we can go. The Stoic views space, or sometimes time and space together, from a perspective outside the observer. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 6:36. Asia and Europe are corners of the universe. The whole of the sea is a drop in the universe. Athos, a tiny cloud of dirt in the universe. All the present time is one point in eternity. Everything is small, easily changing, disappearing. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 8:21. Short-lived are both the praiser and the praised, the rememberer and the remembered. And all this in just one corner of this continent. And yet even here we are not in accord with each other, nor with ourselves, and the whole of the earth too is a speck. Seneca, Consolation to Marcia, 21:2. This earth with its cities and peoples, its rivers and encircling sea, if measured by the universe, we may regard as a mere dot. Our life occupies a portion smaller than a dot, if it is compared with all of time, because the measure of eternity is greater than that of the world. The world recreates itself over and over within the bounds of time. 3. Perishability. The scale of time and space makes all human doing seem small. To this, the Stoic adds that such doings are also highly perishable. All human works, and for that matter, all works of nature, soon change and are gone. This perspective is a help toward the detachment from externals, urged in Chapter 2. Marcus Aurelius. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 7:34. Consider that as the heaps of sand piled on one another hide the former sands, so in life the events which go before are soon covered by those which come after. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 5:23. Think often about how quickly everything that exists and that is coming into being is carried away and disappears. For substance is like a river that constantly flows on. The action is constantly changing, and the causes of it operate in endless variations. Almost nothing is fixed. And next to us is the boundless abyss of what has passed by, and what is about to be, into which all things are lost. How then is he not a fool who gets worked up and carried away over these things, complaining as if they were enduring and troublesome? Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 9:28. Soon the earth will cover us all. Then the earth itself will be changed, and whatever comes next will continue to be changed endlessly. Then those things again to infinity. Someone who contemplates the successive waves of change and alteration and their speed will look down upon all mortal things. Seneca. Seneca Epistles 71:15. The sage will say just what Marcus Cato would say on thinking over his past life. The whole human race, both that which is and that which is to be, is condemned to die, as were the cities that ever held sway over the world, and those that have been the splendid ornaments of empires not their own. Some day people will ask where they were. So why should I be angry or feel sorrow if I precede the fate common to all things by a tiny interval of time? That passage refers to Cato the Younger, a Stoic who had died about 40 years before Seneca was born. Cato was a famously scrupulous statesman and an opponent of Julius Caesar. When Caesar prevailed over Pompey and his forces in the Roman Civil War, Cato used a sword to take his own life rather than surrender and submit. He became part of the Stoic roster of heroes and was sometimes cited as an example of the ideal wise man. We will see further references to him later in the book. Seneca offered some more specific prophecies about the passing of human creations. Seneca, Epistles, 91:11-12. The works of nature itself are under attack, so we ought to bear the destruction of cities with equilibrium. They stand but to fall. A common doom awaits them, whether by the explosion of some internal force, and blasts that are violent so long as their exit is blocked, or whether age, from which nothing is safe, will wear them down bit by bit, or whether severity of climate will drive their people away, and neglect will destroy what they have abandoned. All the ways their fate may arrive would be tedious to relate, but this one thing I know: all works of mortals are doomed to mortality. We live in the midst of things destined to die. Seneca, Consolation to Polybius, 1:1-2. The 7 wonders of the world, and things far more wonderful than those which, if such there be, the ambition of succeeding years has brought forth, will one day be seen leveled to the ground. So it is. Nothing is everlasting, and few things are long-lasting. Different things perish in different ways. Their endings may be varied, but whatever begins also ceases. Let him go, he who would mourn departed spirits one by one, who would weep over the ashes of Carthage and Numantia and Corinth, and any place loftier that has fallen, when even this universe, which has no place to fall, is going to perish. Let him go too, he who would complain that fate, which will one day dare so great a crime, has not spared him. The 7 wonders of the world were sights featured in ancient books telling the Hellenistic traveler where to visit and what to see, such as the Colossus of Rhodes and the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. From this list that Seneca had in mind, only the Great Pyramid of Giza now survives. Carthage in modern Tunisia, Numantia in modern Spain, and Corinth in Greece were cities that Rome had destroyed during conflicts in the 2nd century BC. Seneca noted, too, that the forces of dissolution usually work much faster than the forces of creation. Seneca, Epistles 91:6. It would be some consolation for the feebleness of ourselves and our works if all things should perish as slowly as they come into being. But as it is, increases are of sluggish growth, but the way to ruin is rapid. A variation on our general theme from Montaigne. Montaigne, of the Education of Children, 1580. This great world, which some would say is only one species within a genus, is the mirror in which we must look to see ourselves from the right perspective. So many revolutions, so many changes in the fates of nations, teach us to see our own fate as no cause for astonishment. So many names, so many victories and conquests buried in oblivion, make it ridiculous for us to hope to immortalize our names by capturing a bunch of soldiers and some chicken coop that is remembered only for being destroyed. As a way to bring home the perishability of human lives and works, Marcus Aurelius often would review examples of those that came before and passed on. If the cases he cites are no longer vivid to us, his claim is stronger still, but of course modern illustrations can readily be devised if one wants them. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 4:28. Expressions that used to be familiar now require explanation. In the same way, the names of people who used to be heroes now need some explanation. Camillus, Caesar, Phalesus, Leonidas, a little later Scipio, and Cato too, then also Augustus, then also Hadrian and Antoninus. For all things fade and become mere tales, and are buried soon thereafter in complete oblivion. And I'm speaking just of those who have shone in some way with great brilliance. As for the rest, they are gone and forgotten when they take their last breath. And what, after all, is even an everlasting remembrance? Completely empty. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 4:32. Picture in your mind, as an illustration, the times of Vespasian. You will see all these things: people marrying, raising children, getting sick, dyeing, making war, celebrating festivals, being merchants, being farmers, flattering others, being arrogant, being suspicious, plotting, wishing for some people to die, grumbling about the present, loving, laying up treasure, setting their hearts on consulships and kingdoms. Well, the life of those people no longer exists at all. Now pass ahead to the time of Trajan. It's all the same things again, and that life too is gone. Carefully view other eras and other nations the same way, and see how many, after strenuous exertion, soon fell and were resolved into the elements. Vespasian had been Roman emperor from 69 to 79 AD, about a century before Marcus Aurelius. 4. Applications to mortality. The perspectives encouraged by the Stoics are a countermeasure against many deceptions, vices, and misjudgments, including the fear of death. That topic will be fully treated in the next chapter, but the use of our current ideas to address it can be shown briefly and generally here. That is the application of the long view to reduce the fear of mortality. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 4:50. It is a simple but still useful help toward contempt of death to call to mind those who have clung tenaciously to life. What did they gain beyond those who died early? Regardless, they were all buried somewhere eventually. Catichanus, Fabius, Julianus, Lepidus, anyone like that. They carried out many to be buried, then were carried out themselves. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 4:47. If one of the gods told you that you would die tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, at the latest, you wouldn't consider the choice between those days important, unless you were very small-minded. For how much difference is there? Likewise, the difference between dying at a great age and dying tomorrow, you should consider no great thing. Compare Plato, Republic, Book 6, 486, A to B. Do you think that a mind habituated to thoughts of grandeur and the contemplation of all time and all existence can deem this life of man a thing of great concern? Impossible, said he. Hence, such a man will not suppose death to be terrible, least of all. Montaigne, that to study philosophy is to learn to die, 1580. Aristotle tells us of little creatures on the river Hipponus that live for only a day. One that dies at 8 in the morning dies young. One that dies at 5 in the evening dies of old age. Who would not laugh to see the difference between such momentary lifespans counted as happiness or unhappiness? Yet calling our own lives long or short, when they are compared with eternity, or even to the spans of mountains, rivers, stars, trees, and certain other animals, seems no less absurd. Montaigne's reference is to Aristotle, History of Animals, 5:17-14. 5. Reduction. We turn to a different Stoic use of perspective, of the microscope, perhaps, rather than the telescope. Chapter 2 looked at some Stoic methods for demystifying externals, viewing them literally or reducing them to smaller elements, thus making it easier to take them lightly. Marcus Aurelius applied the approach not just to particular externals, but to human life and to the world in general. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 8:24. The sort of thing that bathing appears to be, when you think about it, oil, sweat, filth, greasy water, everything revolting. Such is every part of life, and everything that underlies it. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 4:48. To sum up, do not overlook how short are the lives of all mortal things, and how insignificant. Yesterday a little blob of mucus, tomorrow a mummy or ashes. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 8:37. All this is foul smell and blood in a bag. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 9:36. The rottenness of the matter that underlies everything, water, dust, bone, stench, or again, as marble is only a stone in the earth, and gold and silver are only sediments, and clothing is only hair, and purple dye is only blood, and everything else is just as these are. The life breath in us is another similar thing and changes from this to that. 6. Repetition. Another Stoic maneuver of perspective observes the sameness of things that seem novel, thereby draining them of their power to provoke attachment. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 6:46. It is tiresome to go to the theater or other such places and see the same things over and over again. It makes watching them tedious. It is the same in the whole of life, for all things above and below are the same and from the same sources. How long, then? Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 7:1. So for everything that happens, keep this in mind. It is something you have seen many times before. Look up and down, in short, and you will find the same things that the histories are filled with. Ancient histories, histories of the intervening years, histories of our times, and that fill the cities and the houses of today. Nothing is new. Everything is both familiar and short-lived. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 7:49. Carefully consider the past, the countless changes of political regimes. You can also see future events in advance. They will be of entirely the same kind, for it is impossible to depart from the pattern of what is happening now. It follows that to have observed human life for 40 years is the same as for 10,000. For what more are you going to see? Lest these perspectives seem excessively somber, Seneca, Epistles 101:9. When a steadfast mind knows that there is no difference between a day and an age, whatever the days or events that may come, then it can look out from the heights and laugh as it reflects on the succession of the ages. 7. The overhead view. Some of the perspectives considered so far can be brought home at once with an imaginative exercise, viewing humanity from a sufficiently high perspective to see it all at once. The intended effect is to help us naturally reach some of the familiar Stoic conclusions, such as the repetitive character of human life and the perishability of it. Seneca, Natural Questions 1, Preface 8. The mind cannot despise colonnades, paneled ceilings gleaming with ivory, manicured shrubbery, and streams made to approach mansions, until it goes around the entire universe and looking down upon the earth from above, an earth limited and covered mostly by sea, while even the part out of the sea is squalid or parched and frozen, says to itself, "Is this the pinpoint that is divided by sword and fire among so many nations?" Marcus Aurelius returned often to this vantage point. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 7:48. This is a fine saying of Plato, that a person who is going to discuss human affairs should examine earthly things as if looking down from somewhere above, groups of men, armies, tilled fields, marriages, divorces, births, deaths, the noise of the law courts, the deserts, the patchwork of foreign peoples, festivals, mournings, markets, the whole mixture, and the orderly arrangement of opposites. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 9:30. Look down from above on the countless gatherings and countless ceremonies, and every sort of voyage in storm and calm, and the disputes between those being born, living together, and dying. Think also of the life that was lived by others long ago, and that will be lived after you, and that is being lived now in other countries. Think of how many don't know your name at all, how many will quickly forget it, how many who, perhaps praising you now, will soon be finding fault. Realize that being remembered has no value, nor does your reputation, nor anything else at all. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 12:24. If, being suddenly lifted up in midair, you should examine human affairs and their variety from above, you will look down upon them, and however often you are lifted up, you will see the same things, the same kind, their short duration, vanity, on account of these things. A similar theme is pursued in Cicero's Dream of Scipio, Cicero on the Republic, 6:19-20. Though marveling at these things, I was still turning my eyes back to earth from time to time, Then Africana said, I can tell that you are now contemplating man's dwelling and abode. If it appears as small to you as it really is, look always up to these celestial things, and down on those human ones. For what renown in men's mouths can you attain? What fame worth seeking? 8. Implications. We arrive at the conclusion of Seneca. Seneca, Natural Questions 3, 1, Preface 15. We believe these affairs of ours are great because we are small. On the implications of human lowliness, Marcus Aurelius, the Stoic most preoccupied with the theme, had definite views. They were humble and benevolent. We should treat each other well and with good humor, for the things that distract us from those simple aims aren't worth worrying about. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 5:33. The things highly valued in life are empty and rotten and trivial. We are little dogs biting each other, quarrelsome children laughing and then crying. Reputation in such a world is meaningless. What then? You graciously wait for death, for extinction, or for passage to another state. And until the time for that has arrived, what is enough? What else but to venerate and praise the gods, to do good to others, and to treat them with tolerance and restraint? And as for what is within the bounds of your body and your breath, to remember that it is neither yours nor up to you. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 7:3. The empty pursuit of ceremony plays on the stage, men with flocks of sheep, or in herds, or fighting with spears, a bone thrown to little dogs, a crumb into the fish ponds, the hard labors of burden-bearing ants, the scurrying of panicky little mice, tiny puppets moved by strings. Among all these things you must take your place, with good humor and without being haughty, understanding, however, that each man is worth just as much as the things he cares about. Progress in Stoicism, or temperamental aptitude for it, might be measured in part by one's ability to read the ideas in this chapter and come away in better humor rather than worse, and with greater purpose rather than less. Some would regard Marcus Aurelius as a notably poor motivational speaker. For the Stoic, he is among the only kind tolerable. Chapter 4. Death. Death has two kinds of significance for the Stoics. First, it may be considered an external. It is out of our control. We can accelerate death, and sometimes delay it, but its eventual arrival is not up to us. It is also the most frightening prospect the mind confronts. An external that is frightening makes a natural topic for Stoic analysis, so death gets their attention at length. Stoics consider death hard to see accurately, and they find the usual attitude toward it irrational. What death is like is unknown to anyone, but it appears to be a painless state that leaves us no worse off than we were before we were born. They also view death as similar to other changes that are familiar to all, and as a continuous process rather than a sudden one. We die every day as our time on earth passes behind us. They make various other arguments as well to drain the terror from mortality. Overcoming the fear of death is considered by the Stoics to be one of the most important of all philosophical achievements, and the gain of an important liberty. But Stoicism treats death as more than just an external that needs to be laid bare. It is also a source of perspective and inspiration, a valuable aid, not just something to which we overreact. Mortality is the defining feature of our existence. Stoics want the imminence of it to inform their daily lives. The fact that we will soon be gone can induce some of the same changes in mindset as the perspectives considered in the previous chapter. Meditation on death is thus used by the Stoic to stimulate humility, fearlessness, moderation, and other virtues. 1. Fear of death. Before setting out to cure a fear or desire, the Stoics typically analyze the ordinary attitude toward it. They are especially dedicated analysts of the fear of death. Seneca, Epistles 36:8. No one doubts that death has in it something that inspires terror, so that it shocks even our souls, which nature has so molded that they love their own existence, for otherwise there would be no need to prepare ourselves and to whet our courage, to face that towards which we should move with a sort of voluntary instinct, precisely as all men tend to preserve their existence. Seneca, Epistles 82:15-16. Death belongs among those things that are not evils in truth, but still have an appearance of evil. For a love of self is implanted in us, and a desire for existence and survival, and a dread of disintegration. Death seems to rob us of many good things, and to remove us from all we have come to know. And there is another element that estranges us from death. We are already familiar with the present, but are ignorant of the future into which we will go, and we shrink from the unknown. Even if death is something indifferent, then, it is nevertheless a thing that cannot be easily ignored. As will become clear, death has a deep importance in Stoicism that is not shared by other conditions we fear. But at times the Stoics analyze death simply as an external, a thing that gains its meaning from the ways in which it is costumed by the mind. What we must overcome is not death, but the way we think about it. Epictetus Discourses 2:1-13-14. Neither death nor pain is to be feared, but the fear of pain or death. Confidence should therefore be our attitude toward death, and caution should be our attitude toward the fear of it. But now we have the opposite. Toward death, avoidance. Toward our opinions about it, carelessness, indifference, and neglect. Epictetus Discourses 2:1-17. What is death? A mask to frighten children. Turn it and examine it. See, it does not bite. The poor body must be separated from the spirit as it was before, either now or later. Why then are you troubled if it be now? For if not now, later. Seneca, Natural Questions, 6:32-8-9. The thing itself is trifling. That we fear it is serious. Better that it happen once than that it always be threatening. Therefore, exhort yourself as much as you can, Lucilius, against the fear of death. This is the thing that makes us abject. This is what disturbs and destroys the man whose life itself it has spared. This is what magnifies all those things like earthquakes and lightning. 2. Fearlessness of death. Freedom from the fear of death is regarded by the Stoic as one of the central goals of philosophical work, from which many other liberties and goods follow. One who regards death without fear steps more lightly through life, and is free from many other fears as well, for death is the master fear that lies behind them. From Seneca, Seneca Epistles 36:8. What then should he study? That which is helpful against all weapons, against every kind of foe, contempt for death. Seneca Epistles 26:10. He who has learned to die has unlearned slavery. He is above any power, and certainly beyond it. What terrors have prisons and bonds and bars for him? Seneca Epistles 4:5-6. Make life as a whole agreeable to yourself, then, by banishing all worry about it. No good thing makes its possessor happy unless his mind is prepared for its loss, and nothing is easier to let go of than that which, once gone, cannot be missed. Seneca Epistles 61:4. We must make ready for death before we make ready for life. From others, Cicero, Tusculan Disputations 1:30. The whole life of a philosopher is preparation for death. Epicurus, Letter to Meneceus. A correct understanding that death is nothing to us makes the mortality of life enjoyable, not by adding to life a limitless time, but by taking away the yearning after immortality. For life has no terrors for him who has thoroughly understood that there are no terrors for him in ceasing to live. Montaigne, A Custom of the Isle of Scia, 1580. After Philip forced his way into the Peloponnesus, someone told Damindus that the Spartans would suffer greatly if they did not get back into Philip's good graces. "Coward," he replied. "What can people suffer who do not fear death?" Agis was similarly asked how people could live in freedom, to which he replied, by holding death in contempt. Montaigne took these bits from Plutarch's Apophthegmata Laconica, Sayings of the Spartans. The passage speaks of the advance toward Sparta by Philip II of Macedon in 346 BC, or thereabouts, and the Spartans' lack of interest in conciliating him. Philip elected not to seek the conquest of Sparta. Agis was one of the many kings of Sparta by that name. 3. Correctives to fear. The Stoic approach to the fear of death is the same as to other externals. Use reason to see the thing clearly and peel away its frightening features. A. The unknown experience of death. Seneca, Epistles, 91-20. Does it do any harm to a good man to be smeared by unjust gossip? Then we should not let the same sort of thing do damage to death either, in our judgment. For death also has a bad reputation, but none of those who malign death have tried it. See also Plato, Apology, 29a. To fear death, gentlemen, is nothing else than to think one is wise when one is not, for it is thinking one knows what one does not know, for no one knows whether death be not even the greatest of all blessings to man, but they fear it as if they knew that it is the greatest of evils. Montaigne, Use Makes Perfect, 1580. In dying, which is the greatest task we have to perform, practice is no help. We may use habit and experience to strengthen ourselves against pain, poverty, shame, and other misfortunes, but death we can try only once. We are all apprentices with respect to it. There were some in ancient days so meticulous in the use of their time that they even tried to taste and to savor the moment of their deaths. They bent their faculties of mind to discover what it was to cross over, but they never came back to tell their stories. B. The painlessness of death. Dying might be painful. So far as we know, death itself is not. Seneca, Consolation to Marcia, 19:4. Reflect that there are no ills to be suffered after death, that the reports that make the underworld terrible to us are mere tales, that no darkness threatens the dead, no prison, no blazing streams of fire, no river of Lethe, no seats of judgment, no defendants, nor in that freedom so complete are there any tyrants to meet again. All those things are the sport of the poets, who have stirred us up with terrors that are empty. Seneca, Epistles, 4:3. Death is coming to you. It would be a thing to dread if it could stay, but necessarily it either doesn't come or it comes and is gone. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 8:58. He who fears death fears either the loss of sensation or a different kind of sensation. But if you'll have no sensation, you will feel nothing bad. And if you have a different kind of sensation, then you will be a different kind of living being and will not have ceased to live. The similar view of Epicurus. Epicurus, Letter to Manesius. Accustom yourself to thinking that death is nothing to us, since every good and evil lies in perception, while death is the deprivation of perception. Something that causes no trouble when it is present causes pain to no purpose when it is merely expected. Death, the most horrible of evils, is therefore nothing to us, since so long as we exist, death is not present, and when death is present, we do not exist. As for dying itself, it doesn't usually take very long. Montaigne, A Physiognomy, 1580. It is not against death that we prepare. That is too momentary a thing. A quarter of an hour suffering, without after effects and without damage, does not require special instruction. In truth, we prepare ourselves against the preparations for death. C. Death as transformation. Stoics view the arrival of death as a transition not so different from others we know. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations, 9:3. Do not despise death, but be content with it, since this too is one of those things nature wills. For what it is to be young and grow old, and to increase and reach maturity, and to have teeth and beard and gray hair, and to father children, and to be pregnant and to give birth, and all the other natural operations the seasons of your life bring, so also is dissolution. This, then, is the way of one who is reflective, to be neither careless, nor impatient, nor arrogant with respect to death, but to wait for it as one of the operations of nature. Stoicism regards death more specifically as a natural transformation of matter into other forms. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 8:18. That which has died does not fall out of the universe. If it stays here, it also changes here, and is dissolved into its proper parts, which are elements of the universe and of yourself. And these change, too, and they do not complain. Epictetus, Discourses 3:24-94. So I won't exist anymore? No, you won't, but something else will, which the universe now needs. For you also came into existence, not when you chose, but when the world had need of you. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 7:23. From the essence of the universe, as if it were wax, nature molds now a little horse. And when it has broken this up, it uses the material for a little tree, then for a little man, then for something else. And each of these things exists for a very short time. But it is no hardship for a box to be broken up, just as there was none in its being fastened together. D. Comparisons to the time before birth. A classic Stoic response to death is to contemplate its similarity to our position before birth, which we have no reason to think was difficult. Seneca, Epistles 54:4-5. What, I say to myself, does death so often test me? Let it do so. I myself have for a long time tested death. When, you ask? Before I was born. Unless I am mistaken, my dear Lucilius, we go astray in thinking that death follows, when it has both preceded and will follow. Whatever condition existed before our birth was death. For what does it matter whether you do not begin at all, or whether you end, when the result in either case is non-existence? Cicero, Tusculan Disputations 1:4. Perhaps I do not yet express what I mean, for I look upon this very circumstance, not to exist after having existed, to be very miserable. What? More so than not to have existed at all? It follows that those who are not yet born are miserable because they are not, and we ourselves, if we are to be miserable after death, were miserable before we were born. But I do not remember that I was miserable before I was born, and I should be glad to know, if your memory is better, what, if anything, you recollect of your own situation. Plutarch, Consolation to Apollonius 15, 109e to 109f. Those who have died return to the same state in which they were before they were born. Just as there was nothing either good or bad for us before we were born, so neither will there be after the end. And just as things before us were nothing to us, so neither will things after us be anything to us. Montaigne, That to Study Philosophy is to Learn to Die, 1580. How ridiculous to worry about passing into freedom from all worry. Just as our birth brought us the birth of all things, so will our death be the death of them all. And so to be sorry we will not be alive 100 years from now is as foolish as to be sorry we were not alive 100 years ago. E. Comparisons to unreasoning creatures. A recurring line of Stoic argument points to creatures with weak understanding, children, or the foolish, or animals, who avoid the fear of death and other fears that encumber the philosophical type. A kind of inspiration can be drawn from those fearless examples. A larger endowment of reason should not make the philosopher worse off than the person, or pig, who has less of it. Some of these examples involve matters other than death, but all are applicable to it. Seneca, Epistles 36:12. Infants and boys, and those who have gone mad, have no fear of death. It is most shameful if reason cannot give us the same peace of mind to which they are led by their simplicity. Seneca, Epistles 4:4. It is difficult, you say, to bring the mind to a point where it can scorn life. But do you not see that people sometimes do scorn life, and for trifling reasons? One hangs himself in front of the door of his mistress. Another hurls himself from a housetop so that he will no longer have to bear the taunts of a bad-tempered master. A third, to be saved from arrest after running away, drives a sword into his vitals. Do you not suppose that virtue will be as effective as overwhelming fear? Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 5:18. The same ills befall another, and either because he does not see that they have happened, or because he would make a display of pride, he is firm and remains unharmed. It is a shame, then, that ignorance and the desire to impress should be stronger than wisdom. Montaigne, that the taste of good and evil things depends in large part on the opinion we have of them, 1580. Pyrrho, the philosopher, was once aboard a ship during a very great storm. To those near him who were most frightened, he pointed to a hog that was there, and that was not in the least concerned, and sought to encourage them by its example. Do we dare to say that the gift of reason, of which we speak so highly, and which we think makes us masters and kings of the rest of creation, was put into us as a source of torment? What good is knowledge if it causes us to lose the peace of mind and the calm we would enjoy without it, and leaves us in a condition worse than that of Pyrrho's hog? Pyrrho was a Greek philosopher born in the 4th century BC. He is considered the founder of the school of thought known as skepticism. F. Relief. The value of mortality. Marcus Aurelius's view of humanity gave him a reason not to fear death. The human race, seen accurately, is not the sort of company one should be too sorry to leave behind. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 9:3-2. If you want a vulgar form of comfort that touches the heart, reconcile yourself to death by observing, above all, the things from which you will be removed, and the morals of those with whom your soul will no longer have to associate. Do not take offense at them. It is your duty, rather, to care for them and to gently put up with them. But nevertheless remember that you will be departing from others who do not have the same opinions you do. That is the one consideration, if any, that would pull the other way and attach us to life, if we could live with those who share our opinions. But when you see how much trouble arises from the discord of all of them living together, it is enough to make you say, "Come quickly, O death, lest somehow I too forget myself." The following passage is in a similar vein. It is not directly linked to death, but urges the same sort of detachment from life and for the same reasons. Marcus Aurelius, Meditations 5:10-1. Turn to the habits of those you live with. They are nearly unbearable, even the most accomplished of them. I hesitate to say it, but a man can scarcely bear even himself. In such darkness and filth, then, in such a constantly changing flow of substance and of time, of motion and things moving, what is worth prizing highly or seriously pursuing, I cannot conceive. Seneca reflected on the suffering that comes with life and on our eventual decrepitude, and on the shameful things people do to make life a little longer when they can. And he ended with this conclusion: "Mortality is a gift." Seneca, Epistles 101:14. Deny now, if you can, that nature is very generous in making death inevitable. Montaigne elaborated in the guise of speaking for nature. Montaigne, that to study philosophy is to learn to die, 1580. Just imagine how much less bearable and more painful an immortal life would be for mankind than the life I have given you. If you did not have death, you would curse me forever for depriving you of it. Indeed, I have deliberately mixed death with a little bitterness to prevent the advantages of it from causing you to embrace it too quickly or too rashly, to keep you in the moderate state that I wish, not fleeing either from life or from death. I have tempered each of those states with pleasure and with pain. 4. The progressive character of death. The Stoic seeks to befriend death by removing illusions about it. One is that death is an eventuality in the distance. The Stoics attack that impression in several ways. First, they view death as a continuous process rather than an event. We all are dying. Each day that passes is an increment of mortality. Seneca, Epistles 1:2. Who can you show me that places any value on their time? Who knows the worth of each day? Who understands that they are dying daily? For we are mistaken when we see death ahead of us. The greater part of it has happened already. Whatever of our life is behind us is in death's hands. Seneca, Epistles 24:19. We do not suddenly fall on death, but advance toward it by slight degrees. We die every day. For every day, a little of our life is taken from us. Even when we are growing, our life is on the wane. We lose our childhood, then our boyhood, and then our youth. Right up to yesterday, all past time is lost time. The very day we are now spending is shared between ourselves and death. It is not the last drop that empties the water clock, but all that has flowed out already. Montaigne, That to Study Philosophy is to Learn to Die, 1580. Why fear your last day? It does no more to advance you toward death than any other day did. The last step does not cause your fatigue. It reveals your fatigue. Every day is a step toward death. The last one arrives there. Compare Schopenhauer, Our Relation to Ourselves, 1851. Each day is a little life. Every waking and rising a little birth. Every fresh morning a little youth. Every going to rest and sleep a little death. 5. The availability of death. The Stoic regards death as an option rather than a terror. The option becomes, in turn, a source of courage in life. The ability to end one's own life is therefore an important freedom. If life is intolerable, as Epictetus puts it, the doorway out is open. Epictetus Discourses 2:1-19. What is pain? A scary mask. Turn it around and examine it. The poor flesh is sometimes treated roughly, sometimes smoothly. If this does not profit you, the doorway out is open. If it does, bear it. Seneca. Seneca Epistles 70:14-15. The best thing external law ever ordained was one entrance into life, but many exits. Must I await the cruelty either of disease or of man, when I can depart in the midst of torture and shake off my troubles? This is the one reason why we cannot complain of life. It keeps none of us against our will. Humanity is well situated, in that none are unhappy except by their own fault. Live if it suits you. If not, you can go back where you came from. However, Seneca Epistles 24:22, 24:25. We need to be warned and strengthened in both directions, not to love or to hate life overmuch. Even when reason advises us to make an end of it, the impulse is not to be adopted without reflection or at headlong speed. The brave and wise man should not flee from life, but withdraw from it. Montaigne, A Custom of the Isle of Scia, 1580. The most voluntary death is the finest. Our life depends on the will of others. Our death depends on our own. In nothing should we defer to our own feelings as much as in this. What others think has nothing to do with this business. It is madness to even consider it. Living is slavery if the freedom to die is lacking. Montaigne, An Apology for Raymond Sebond, 1580. Here are the words of the law on this subject. If chance delivers some great misfortune that you cannot remedy, a haven is always nearby. You can swim away from your body as you would from a leaking boat. Only fools are attached to their bodies by a fear of death rather than a love of life. 6. Duration versus quality. The impression that death lies in the distance can create a desire to keep it there, or as far away as possible, to treat the length of a life as the most important thing about it. The Stoic, to the contrary, is more concerned with the quality of life than its duration. Virtue and honor are goods not measured in time. The person who has them has lived long enough. Seneca, Epistles 22:17. Men do not care how nobly they live, but only how long, although it is within the reach of every man to live nobly, but within no man's power to live long. Seneca, Epistles 101:15. What matters is not how long you live, but how well, and often living well means that you cannot live long. Seneca, Epistles 77:4. A journey will be incomplete if you stop halfway, or anywhere on this side of your destination. But a life is not incomplete if it is honorable. Wherever you leave off, provided you leave off nobly, your life is a whole. Often, it is true, one must leave off bravely, and not necessarily for momentous reasons, for neither are the reasons momentous that hold us here. Seneca, Epistles 78:26-27. One who roams through the universe will never weary of the truth. It is the false things that will bring on disgust. And on the other hand, if death comes near with its summons, even though it be untimely in its arrival, and even if it cuts you off in your prime, you will have had the enjoyment of all that the longest life can give. The universe, in great measure, will have been known to you. You will understand that honorable things do not depend on time for their growth, while every life must seem short to those who measure its length by pleasures that are empty, and for that reason unbounded. Seneca, Epistles 93:8. You ask what the finest lifespan would be? To live until you reach wisdom. The one who gets there has arrived, not at the farthest goal, but at the most important. That man indeed may boldly congratulate himself and give thanks to the gods, and to himself along with them, and count in his reckoning with the universe the fact that he has lived. His account will be in credit. He has given it back a better life than he received. While commendation is not high on the list of Stoic aims, this comment from Plutarch is in the same spirit as those just considered. Plutarch, Letter to Apollonius 17:3a-b. Not the longest life is the best, but the best lived, for it is not the one who has played the lyre the most, or made the most speeches, or piloted the most ships who is commended, but the one who has done these things well. To turn the point around, a life lived trivially is, in effect, short. Seneca, On the Shortness of Life, 7:10. There is no reason for you to think anyone has lived long just because he has gray hairs or wrinkles. He has not lived long. He has existed long. For suppose you should imagine that a man had a great voyage, when in fact he was caught by a fierce storm as soon as he left harbor, was swept this way and that by strong winds from different directions, and was driven along the same path in circles. He did not make a great voyage. He was greatly tossed about. Seneca, Epistles 93:11. He didn't live as long as he might have. And some books contain few lines, but are admirable and useful in spite of their size. Then there are the Annals of Tanusius. You know how ponderous the book is and what people say about it. The long life of a certain sort of person is like that, a kind of Annals of Tanusius. Seneca appears to be referring to Tanusius Geminus, a historian from the 1st century B.C., who evidently was long-winded, but from whom, for better or worse, very little has survived. Catullus, a Roman poet from around the same era, famously made fun of a historian from that time by referring to his writings as cacata carta, politely translated as toilet paper. One scholarly school of thought holds that Catullus was referring in a veiled way to the Annals of Tanusius, and that this is what Seneca meant when he referred, with a delicate lack of specificity, to what people say about that book. The party whose death is under discussion in that last passage is Metronax, a friend of Seneca's who will appear again in Chapter 7, Section 8. 7. The Manner of Death. Fearlessness of death is regarded by the Stoics as a great achievement, and the way one confronts death when it arrives is considered a test of that achievement and of character, perhaps the true test. Seneca, Epistles 26:6. This is what I mean. Your debates and learned talks, your maxims gathered from the teachings of the wise, your cultured conversation, all these afford no proof of the real strength of your soul. Bold speech may issue even from the timid. What you have accomplished will only become evident when you draw your last breath. I accept the terms. I do not shrink from the judgment. Seneca, Epistles 77:20. It is with life as with a play. What matters is not how long it is, but how good. It makes no difference at what point you stop. Leave off where you choose. Just be sure to give it a good ending. Seneca, Epistles 24:9. I can show you not only brave men who have made light of the moment when the soul breathes its last, but some who, if undistinguished in other respects, matched the spirit of the bravest when it came to this one thing. Consider Scipio, Pompey's father-in-law, when he was being driven back toward Africa by headwinds, and saw his ship being seized by the enemy. He ran himself through with his sword. To the men who were asking, "Where is the commander?" he answered, "All is well with the commander." That statement made him the equal of his ancestors, and it did not allow the glory of the African Scipios, ordained by destiny, to be interrupted. It was a great deed to conquer Carthage, but a greater deed to conquer death. All is well with the commander. The Scipio to whom Seneca refers, Metellus Scipio, as he is sometimes known, was a commander who, like Cato the Younger, sided against Caesar in the Roman Civil War, and who, like Cato, took his own life at the end of it. The ancestors of Metellus Scipio that Seneca has in mind most prominently include Scipio Africanus, the Roman general who had defeated Hannibal in the Second Punic War against Carthage about 150 years earlier. Metellus was not regarded as one of the more impressive of the Scipios, very much the contrary. But he was felt to have died well. To return to our theme via Montaigne,